You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 13th of October 2012. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A new face on the Lebanese newsstands, a bilingual arts journal, and a refreshing take on aviation publishing. All that, plus one of England's most celebrated fashion writers and the editor of The White Review. Plenty to look forward to on episode 7 of The Stack with me, your guest host, Tom Edwards. Also coming up in a special feature-length interview, we speak to American media magnate and domestic goddess Martha Stewart.
Despite the great number of iPads that have been sold and other tablets, the adoption of the digital magazine has not occurred so rapidly.
Plus, we talk to the author of one of the most tactile books we've ever received, entitled Paper, an Elegy.
Our consumption of paper, the production of paper, uses of paper, all of these things are expanding rather than contracting, which I didn't expect to discover at all. I was prepared to say, you know, this could be the end of the age of paper. In fact, it's a boom period.
All that and a few more reading tips live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. Hello and welcome to Edition 7 of The Stack, a fresh addition to our weekend lineup here on Monocle 24. Each Saturday we sit down with editors and photographers, correspondents and creative directors to review the very best in established weeklies and obscure journals, big city dailies and one-off personal projects, and keep an eye on the forces shaping the industry. We have lots to come in the next hour, but before that, let's meet our guests. Our two guest magazine reviewers are sitting here, bright-eyed and eager, ready to work through a stack of magazines. The first is the celebrated fashion editor, Marion Hume. Now, Marion's career spans many continents. Her resume includes stints at Vogue Australia, US Harper's Bazaar, and Time, Style and Design. She's now based here in London as the international fashion editor for the Australian Financial Review, and we're very glad to welcome her to Midori House. Marion, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Very happy to be here.
How are you today? It's a fairly bright and breezy day.
I'm feeling quite bright and breezy.
Excellent. Looking very happy. So we're delighted for you to join us. Now, I gather you've recently returned from East Africa. Is that right? I wondered about the sort of state of the print nation there, as it were. What's sort of happening in that area?
Well, ashamed to say I haven't brought East African magazines. I've brought South African magazines. But that's not to say there aren't any in East Africa. But I'm afraid I left it until the airport at Nairobi to scoop them up, and of course got there and the reading matter at Nairobi Airport, where the London flight leaves at midnight officially, but usually about 1 a.m, is very political magazines, which I do read for my other role at the United Nations Ethical Fashion Initiative, but don't really feel like reading at midnight.
And I can see that would be a bit of a test for the brand.
Yeah,
so
no East African magazines, but a couple from South Africa instead.
Oh, well, we may be taking a look at some of those a little bit later on. Also joining us in the studio is Benjamin Eastham, the editor of The White Review, a quarterly arts and literary journal specialising in works from new or emerging artists and writers. Ben, welcome to Midori House. Now, obviously, it's been Frieze Week in London. It's hugely important on the sort of art scene. I imagine, has that been dominating your attention this week?
Well, it's been dominating my attention. I'm not sure I'm getting invited to the right parties. certainly not the important ones. But yes, I've been walking around and trying to convince bouncers to let me in to lots of places. It's occasionally succeeding.
It's something of an art, isn't it? I was there this week. What did you make? Did you get a chance to visit the Frieze Masters? What did you make of the addition of that to the scene?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed Frieze Masters. It's a strange thing because it's so discombobulating to walk around and see such kind of strange juxtapositions, to see whole booths devoted to, you know, North African art, and then to walk around and see a Picasso next door. So it's a slightly strange experience. Makes the whole thing feel like even more of a, I don't know, like the compression of the entire art world into one huge marquee.
It's quite an intense process. I wondered, in terms of your sort of with your professional hat on, the role of, you know, the print coverage of events like that. Do you still feel they're like right at the heart of it? I mean, you said maybe you're feeling personally slightly marginalised by some of these brass bouncers, but do you still feel that the role of that, the criticism and that analysis, is still really fundamental to it?
I feel personally, I think Frieze is slightly beyond criticism. I think it's no longer an event that is defined by its critical reception. Much as it's important that it gains good publicity, it's a fair. You know, it's like the kind of, it's like selling cars, really. You know, a good review is helpful, but really it's about how many cars you sell. So it's a slightly strange... I don't know how it's covered. I don't think people even react to it anymore. It's just a circus. And actually what's going on, the interesting things and what people actually care about, go on outside the marquee at night, shadily. It's always
more interesting what's going on in the what's going on in the shadows in the background. Marion, you've obviously been back from this trip. You're talking about these South African magazines. It's still quite a vibrant market for magazines, isn't it? Like across the continent of Africa. Do you think it's still something of an untapped gem that we could
be seeing
more from?
I think we are seeing, you know, Africa rising. I mean, they're occasionally where I work, which is at a very creative hub in downtown Nairobi, where the UN run a sizable sort of fashion business for Vivienne Westwood and Stella McCartney, producing bags and accessories, and Sass and Bide, the Australian designers. But around us are lots of other creative industries. And, you know, I'll see fashion editors, fashion stylists who are... You know, I'm not someone that reaches for a camera, actually, but I kind of commit their images to memory. And we've actually just launched for East Africa a sort of local range of product. And it's named after the tribute names of these various Kenyan fashion stylists and fashion writers who are just a joy to behold and full of very interesting ideas about what they want, very keyed into fashion, perhaps not in the way of dropping brand names like Louis Vuitton or whatever. It's not that kind of market, but it's very vibrant, it's very exciting. And the street style is just fantastic. Really fantastic.
There must be something kind of refreshing about a market like that that's so free of, I suppose, the slight cynicism that we have in these more developed markets, both the fashion market and the fashion media market. There's a certain cynicism. People are fairly sceptical. It must be quite nice to have that access to something that seems so untapped and sort of ready to be nurtured and to grow like that.
I guess for the big brands, they're looking at it as the next continent. Of course, South Africa already has enormous designer business, but East Africa, you know, the big brands they must be kind of looking around. There's only a couple of shopping malls, as I know so far, but what's more exciting to me is how the people around me, how they dress when they turn up to work. There's one woman that I work with closely who one day will be kind of rocking a 60s look and the next day will be kind of doing an early 80s look. And it's just wonderful. It's really inspiring. I'm afraid I turn up looking quite dull every day and then feel slightly ashamed.
I can't possibly believe that. And Ben, just to sort of go back on what you were saying and to reflect that idea about these sort of, you know, emerging markets, emerging talent, do you think... Briefly, just you mentioned with Frieze, these big established junkets. Does it make it in some ways more difficult because it's become increasingly commercialised and kind of capitalised for, you know, young talent to certainly get a foothold at these events? Are they just dealing in commodities instead? Or do you think there's still the outlets? As you say, they're just, you have to look slightly further afield.
Well, I think Frieze particularly has tried to legislate against this accusation by introducing a project section, which is very ostentatiously about new art and about non-commercial art, which is interesting because it does give great young artists an opportunity to be in this part of this huge junket, but is also perhaps slightly disingenuous. It feels a little bit like a kind of a lost leader to justify the rest of what's going on. So you have these very strange and unusual projects and performances going on as part of Frieze, to make it feel like an artistic endeavour rather than a mere fair. And I suppose, it's a good thing and there are good artists getting shown and young people are getting a great chance to present their work to the art world. But whether you consider it, how you kind of contextualize it, if this is a good thing or if it's a bad thing. I'm not sure.
Well, we'll be touching upon that later. We've got some interesting new arts titles that we'll be taking a look at a little bit later on in the programme. But for now, let's look to the world of paper. The brilliant painter J.M.W. Turner urged aspiring artists to first respect their paper. He was but one in a long line of aficionados, appreciators of the most flexible and versatile of mediums. Well, a little earlier, I caught up with the author Ian Sampson, whose new book, Paper, An Elegy, charts both the place in the world of paper as well as its paradoxes, durable yet vulnerable, ephemeral and yet everlasting. Ian started by explaining his lifelong obsession with the material and why now was the perfect time to document its storied history.
I'm old enough to remember some years ago people talking about this idea of the paperless office, the idea that the time was coming very soon when we would come into our places of work and we would sit down at our screens and no piece of paper would pass through our hands during the course of the day. And this was a very, very good thing. There's a, you know, praise be, because we're not despoiling the environment as a consequence. In fact, what has happened is that it just keeps on expanding. Paper is a technology that we've used for 2,000 years, and it served us very, very well for that long period of time. And actually, when I started to research the book and to look at our consumption of paper, the production of paper, uses of paper, all of these things are expanding rather than contracting, which I didn't expect to discover at all. I was prepared to say, you know, this could be the end of the age of paper. In fact, it's a boom period for paper, particularly, let's say, places like China.
An area that's obviously of particular interest, I think, to Monocle is that of magazines. And we've seen an interesting history, obviously, during the 20th century when certain periodicals would become hugely popular. And it was about people's accessibility to information that otherwise they would not be able to gather. There's undeniably been a difference in terms of how people engage with their media, with new technologies, the internet. They're quite liberating of information. The magazine world is another one where people have suggested that its demise was imminent. But in fact, a lot of quite high-end products, magazines delivered on, you know, great quality paper stock, where people have obviously spent money, taken a lot of time and care over the detail, those things are actually going from strength to strength. And it's some of the kind of cheaper mass market products that are being doomed. As a sort of paper aficionado, what do you make of the magazine market? Do you think that echoes some of these other trends that we see throughout these paper worlds?
I think there are three possible reasons for what you've just described. On the one hand, it could just be nostalgia. It's like old maps. People like to have a map. Even if they're not particularly, they like the idea of a paper map. So you go on a walk in the Lake District, it feels kind of crap if you're doing it with your iPhone. But you get out your pocket Wainwright, or you get out a nice half-inch Bartholomew map with that kind of lovely tweedy on Dunner paper on linen, and you just think, this is delightful. This is a delightful thing. So there's a nostalgic aspect to it. There's also, related to that, the simple fact of this material question. I would have thought with magazines, what you have is a prime example of people wanting to hold something that is, with a nice magazine, it's kind of soft, it's kind of glossy, I mean, literally glossy, all of those things that you can't, you can bend it and do all of those things. And so the form is almost more important, not necessarily, but almost more important than the content. It is not, there's not a strict kind of equation between what you get in a magazine and when you're reading it online. It's not the same thing. So there's I can't remember who it was, somebody like Lewis Mumford, one of these great kind of mid-20th century thinkers about technology, made the point that when you add a technology into a culture, you don't get the same culture that you had before, plus the technology, you get a fundamentally different kind of culture, rather. So, and it's exactly the same, I think, with paper at the moment.
Now, we've talked about the book. I can't stop caressing.
Stroke away.
I can't stop caressing the cover. It's so pleasant. It does indeed have a lovely tactile quality, this sort of embossed paper. There's a number of sections in the book where your obvious sort of love and enthusiasm for the medium and for books in particular comes through. There's a really sweet anecdote about your purchase of the of a certain volume of the Oxford English Dictionary. Just remind us about that.
Yes. When my first novel was published, this was a very exciting moment for me. Obviously, I'd worked very, very hard for many, many years and eventually someone decided they would publish my first book. So I got a small advance for this, for the first book. And when I got the small advance and I got the money in my hands, I immediately went to a shop and bought the 20-volume OED, which cost, at the time, I think it was thousands of pounds, and the equivalent of my advance. So in effect, I had written a book in order to buy another book. And in many ways, nothing has really changed. Almost every penny that I made through writing this book about paper, I've already spent on buying paper.
That was Ian Sansom, author of Paper, an Elegy. I have the book here. We were taking a look at it during that piece. And as I remarked during the interview there, it is a very sort of pleasant book to hold in your hands. I've been showing it around to our guests here. And it sort of prompted us to discuss the delights of paper. And Ben, you were mentioning how in your production of the magazine, you often get sort of intriguing correspondence from what I would call them, paper enthusiasts.
Yeah, there's a whole subset of society who remain silent normally, but occasionally get in touch with us to comment on the quality of our paper. We did an interview last year with an American magazine, and one of their questions was from a reader, and it asked us about the papers, the magazine's intense fungal mask.
I often get probing questions about that as well myself, yeah. Unfortunately.
Which was unexpected. But I think it's part of this entire, which Ian Sansom was discussing there, the idea that the possession of a print magazine or any print publication is now, it's about the entire object now, and it's about all of the, you know, the fact that it's tactile, the quality of the paper, the feel, the smell even. And all of these things now have to be taken into consideration when making a book, because if you're going to go to the bother of actually printing something out rather than distributing it online, then you have to consider the advantages of doing it in that way. And those things are the fact that you can hold it, that it's a kind of a certain type of experience, and you want to use good paper. Using good paper is an important part of that.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be touching upon that more and sampling some paper stock and running the rule over some fungal mass ourselves coming up a little bit shorter. So keep listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24, because after this short break, we'll work our way through our stack of magazines and we'll hear a special feature-length interview with Martha Stewart.
J. Crew's designers strive to make garments that are both functional and versatile. And whether it's a classic 484 jean or a great-fitting Ludlow suit, J. Crew's head menswear designer, Frank Mouchens, is always happy to see his own staples dressed up with a bit of added character, making a look that is distinctly the customer's.
To us, it has always been more about celebrating personal style, and for us, it's important to make, when you wear a J. Crew garment, to make it your own. We're not dictating to wear J. Crew head to toe, but yeah, like I said, it's about celebrating personal style and how you make it your own and give it a different life. And, you know, it's interesting to see what different countries do with our product.
J. Crew.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now it's time to take a look through the wonderful variety of magazines we have with us here in Studio One at Midori House. Marion, let's start with you. You mentioned some of the publications that you've brought in. What have you got there for us?
Well, the first two that I've brought are not really technically magazines. They're fashion lookbooks, because we're just now at the end of the fashion season. So it means that we've all come back from Paris and Milan with these lovely books. I mean, the big brands have switched to electronic lookbooks, which I'm so old-fashioned I find quite tedious. And I actually really
more full them for doing
yes,
so,
exactly.
I say.
I've got this little book here, beautiful paper actually, from Suno, which is a New York-based ethical brand. They produce in Kenya as well, actually. But instead of being ethical in that kind of hemp trousers that don't fit rather ugly kind of way, The whole ambition of Suno is that a gorgeous girl on a hot night in Manhattan can run around in their clothes. And they do these charming little books, which I actually keep. I mean, that just seems a bit kind of dorky, but I do. I keep them.
Well, I think as a connoisseur of the printed word, that seems absolutely appropriate. And surely, I mean, more personal, it's all well and good talking about how easy it is to disseminate information electronically and to reach your target audience more accurately, but I doubt anyone's going to sort of file away an emailed version, are they, to look at another day? Whereas a volume like that, you'd be on your shelves and it's at your fingertips.
Yeah, it's there and I think of them. You know, this little jewel of a book is within my eyeline and I do think of them and perhaps include them in more stories because of it. Young fashion designers, take note. The other one is a lovely little book, very simple, ring-bound, rather old-fashioned in a way, by Akira Isagawa, who's an Australian of Japanese descent who makes beautiful beaded pieces, mostly in Bali and sells in Paris. But this book is just... I was showing it to Ben before we came in here. It's a little gem. It's these beautiful, rather artistic pictures that, you know, occasionally I'll flick through if I need a inspiration of colour or something. And I'm sure, you know, there are lots of other fashion people that treasure these small little gorgeous things.
There are indeed little sort of gems. Ben, what did you make of that one? Do you think it achieves its purpose still much more effectively than these other sort of, you know, supposedly more advanced multimedia platforms?
Well, I think it's a very nice idea that you have something to keep and a memento. And I like the idea that the production of the physical object as well kind of reflects something about, you know, the content inside. So that very beautiful first book, it's just bound very neatly and it's like a lovely little kind of chapbook size on nice paper. And it just, it presents itself very nicely and it gives you something to remember someone by, which is, again, which is, I think, why kind of, you know, printed matter will continue, because everyone likes to have that physical object.
And amongst some of the things you've brought in, are there any that you think particularly achieve that objective of, through the feeling in the hand or the tactile quality, tell you something about, you know, the actual broader purpose they're trying to convey?
This is a magazine called Artlicks, which is run by an editor called Holly Willett and designed by an art director called Ken Curtin. And it's a small arts magazine. It covers a lot of the emerging art by very young artists. And this idea of form and content being interrelated is reflected in the fact that it's produced in this very nice kind of DIY style, I suppose. But it looks very beautiful. And then it produces, coming with it, you get a nice poster which explains the work of a young artist that you can fold out and use. And I just think it's a nice idea that they should extend the purpose of a magazine beyond just text on a page and find other ways of presenting work.
That's a really nice insert. I'm just sort of handing that around the studio so everyone can have a go. On that subject, I feel I should mention this is the latest issue of Underscore magazine. It's their Flight special, and it's basically a whole tranche of stories, features, and photo essays inspired by interpretations of flight. And obviously, some of the aviation magazines, for example, can cover topics in a fairly dry way, sometimes a little austere. But this is really interesting. There's a couple of things I liked. There's a really lovely photo essay from a photographer, Tsunekai Hiramatsu, who photographed fireflies in Okayama Prefecture in Japan. And one of the things that Underscore does is set their chapter segments to a musical score, so you can go online and be entertained by the music and video that sort of accompanies. And there's a really beautiful film and music accompaniment by Christian Loeffler that goes with this Fireflies Forest. But the thing that really got me excited in a fairly schoolboy way, I must admit, and your poster pullout reminded me of it, is Jamie Hyon's Flight of Fancy. This is at the back of the magazine, and on a card insert, there's an actual... Well, I can only describe it as a glorified paper aeroplane.
I thought it was a boomerang.
Well, there's this kind of boomerang shape to one of the wing elements. But it just, I mean, I can imagine children delighting, but the children in us all, I'm certainly got half an eye on taking that out, maybe up to Regent's Park afterwards, trying to pick off some of those freeze bouncers maybe with it after. And I just think it does spark people to look for something, you know, more creative ways to express themselves using the paper.
It was interesting that you were saying about hearing the music, because I'm afraid I've gone completely the other way too with something very, very mass. Although I'm sure Vanity Fair doesn't think of it itself as mass, but it's obviously a very glossy, very successful magazine where the cover says Bond. And you can't even say the word Bond, I think James Bond, without the music, which I will resist singing, but without that going through your head.
It's really interesting how it conjures that sort of thought. And there's certainly blanket coverage, like keeping in printed media across the newspapers here in London this morning. You know, Bond is everywhere, this sort of enduring fascination, all these clever marketing tie-ins that chime in. It's a tricky one, though, because I think sometimes you forget about we've mentioned some sort of emerging markets in Africa, places that maybe are, you know, not used to this sort of mass marketing barrage that we get with likes of Bond. This was another magazine that caught my eye this week. This is Outpost, a new magazine for the Middle East, published out of Beirut. And what struck me was people sometimes talk about paucity of ambition, certainly with new publications. In the editor's brief at the beginning of this, he suggests that when we first set out to create a magazine of possibilities, we had a clear vision in mind to ignite a social and cultural renaissance in the Middle East through inspiring our readers. I thought, well, that's a lofty old ambition.
Aim high.
Well, it's exactly. The power of the written word, you know, since the very beginning and the printing press, why not? Maybe they'll achieve it.
And there's an interesting blend, actually. I don't know what you make of this, Marion, of paper stocks in this. Again, there's some inserts, there's some kind of diary form journalism at the beginning, and then in the more expansive, discursive stuff, they have really interesting diagrams. I must say, actually, some readers of our very own Monocle might sort of recognise some of the stylistic flourishes in there.
It's just reminding me of that.
Yeah,
I think I come at this from a different direction, maybe from Ben, that I look at paper and I go, is it forest certified? You know, I'm very sort of ethical, environmentally driven, and I feel for the, you know, the reuse in paper. But then look at me, here's Vanity Fair, very, very, very glossy. So it's not like I'm not seduced by a lovely glossy cover.
And Ben, that's your first look at that magazine. I just wonder, what's your strategy when someone hands you a new title that you haven't perhaps seen before? Is it first of all how it feels in the hand, or is it always the cover art? Is there anything you sort of always look for straight away?
I think it's actually how it feels in the hand. Having made a lot of books as well, I've worked as a kind of small publisher, publishing little bits, you know, bits and pieces. You can always tell when you pick something up. You can feel the quality, you can see what they've done. This has a very stiff cover, which makes it a bit awkward to read. Things like that, actually, how it's bound, what the paper's like. I get all of that before I even really
consider the content,
which is why I think it's so important how a book presents itself, because while I do it consciously, I do think the majority of readers do it unconsciously as well, that you start making judgments about something once you pick it up, once you see the cover. Once you get a feel for the weight, how it opens, where it opens, if it's difficult to pull to the right page, if the design is slightly hectic, all of these things prejudice your opinion about a piece of printed matter before you've even got into the content. So I think there is a greater awareness now about how things are being presented, and people are putting a lot more effort into innovative ways. But this looks a lot like Monocle, by the way.
Well, I try to put that as diplomatically as possible. I like to think we inspire globally. That's one of our objectives here, of course. And what else have you got in your stack there? Any others that you particularly would like to draw our gaze towards?
I brought this book, this literary magazine from New York that's called N Plus One. And actually, having talked a lot about design, this is not a very well-designed magazine. But it did do something that was a great inspiration to us. It was set up in about 2005 by some quite young guys in Brooklyn. And they were determined to publish long-form essays and quite serious journalism into a variety of subjects. And they've done a fantastic job, and it's been going for 20 issues now. And it was just something I wanted to bring because I think it is the best example of a new type of magazine that's emerging, which is trying to fill the void left by more established magazines that are really feeling commercial pressures to move away from slightly more difficult long-form journalism. And as that's getting squeezed out of the more commercial market, I think there's a whole kind of swathe of magazines coming up in their stead, of which this is probably the best example. So even if you look through it, you can just get a feel for how long the pieces are and what they're about.
That has it has a good substance to it. As you said, perhaps not the most inspirational design-wise, but in some ways that's almost reassuring. I think that you find it's not worrying too much about how it looks. It's outwardly advertising the fact that it's all about the content. Well, I must say a huge thank you to our guests who've joined us on Stack today, to both Marion Hume and to Ben Easton. Thank you both very much for coming into Midori House to join me today. We'll be coming back very shortly with our special interview with Martha Stewart, so stay with us. Now it's time for a special interview here on The Stack. Before our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé, headed out to Toronto, he invited the American media magnate and domestic goddess, Martha Stewart, to Midori House. They sat down to discuss the state of the media industry, the US elections, and exactly what Martha's been up to.
Martha, I wanted to start. We're reasonably well past the two-decade point when you ventured into the print media business. When you look back now, not just at what's happened with Martha Stewart Living, but just the current state of the newsstand. How do you feel about the state of the media right now?
Well, it's actually three decades since I started doing books.
Since you started doing books.
Yeah. And then the magazine started exactly 20 years ago. So it's quite surprising to me that, first of all, we had a fantastic run for 20 years of Martha Stewart Living magazine, our flagship. The circulation grew to over 2 million very quickly and has stayed there with satisfied customers, with people who are avid subscribers. And then the iPad arrived last year, and there was a great flurry, and we did develop probably one of the first and best of the digital apps for a magazine. And our magazine looks beautiful on the iPad. And we thought, and all statistics showed, that right away, within the first 12 months, we would have about 9% of our readership on the digital issue, which we would be very happy with, because it saves a lot of paper, it saves a lot of waste, and it's a much more economical model for magazine publishers than the printed mailed version. However, that hasn't happened, because despite the great number of iPads that have been sold and other tablets, the adoption of the digital magazine has not occurred so rapidly. Some magazines, like the fully printed magazine, maybe like the New Yorker, might have a better ratio of digital to print, but not a big illustrated magazine like ours, where people still like turning the pages, still like dog-earing a page, still like tearing out a picture, still like saving an issue for perusal later on. So it's kind of difficult for us. Oh, and newsstand, bad. And it's been bad for everybody. Right across the board, all kinds of magazines are suffering on the newsstand because people think, and I think rightly so, that all of media had forgotten when the internet started, and this goes back before the iPad, of course, that we shouldn't give away information. Mm. And everybody avidly gave away everything. We're having a big argument now at our company about how much of each new issue should go up on the internet. I feel very strongly that people who are paying for it should have the courtesy of enjoying it themselves until such time as they go off the newsstand. But some people don't think that. And it's like, in the younger generation, they say, oh, they want to get stuff. They'll feel cheated if you don't give it to them. And advertisers should pay for it. But it's so difficult. What do you think?
Well, first, I have to disclose that we're in growth in the U.S., which is great. But I feel that What's happened, particularly on the U.S. newsstand, is that so many magazines just feel the same. They're all the same trim size. They're all on the same paper stock. And there's not a lot of differentiation. And I think, you know, we were talking before we went on air, we were talking about Japanese magazines. If you go to a Japanese newsstand, everyone is on a different paper stock, different trim sizes. And I think Japan's already not quite been through the e-reader revolution, but it's such a digitally evolved society in so many ways. So I think the publisher started to respond earlier. And that, oddly, there's a paralysis in the United States. People don't know what to do. So they only feel we can only be in this environment. I'm pointing at a screen right now.
Yeah.
And there's no other way to go. And yeah, I think it's sad because we've been talking all week about publishing on several of our programs. E-readership in the United States, depending on who you believe, is about 50% of books right now.
Books, yes. I can see books easily. And I, too, have adopted the iPad or the Kindle for my book reading. Not my book buying. I still buy books.
Sure.
But my book reading, because it's so much easier to take it on the airplane. I love the iPad because it's lit and I don't have to turn a light on at night when I'm, you know, having my insomnia attacks so I can read a book or whatever on the iPad. But the newsstand that sort of stymies me, that people are not being as inspired to go to the newsstand and look. Well, there's fewer newsstands, too.
Well, yeah.
Fewer bookstores.
And you're lucky if you live in New York or many of the major cities, which is great. But you really perish the thought that you might live in a third-tier city where they've closed borders and there's maybe Barnes and Noble.
There's not even Barnes and Noble in very many places.
In a lot of places.
Now. Yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is I think that so many people have bought into the Silicon Valley narrative, though, that everything that is proclaimed by the Valley is going to come true. And yet, you know, look at a market like Germany. Germany is very sophisticated. One thing we're talking about this week is, well, Germany, e-reader adoption is only 2%. Yeah, you know, this
2%.
Is a 2%.
Yeah.
And there is still this delight and joy of actually picking up paper. But I don't think it's just that. I think in the German market, you define yourself also by the newspaper that you read. And I think that's one of the strange things. If I see you, Martha, I have no idea what you're reading. You could be reading a manga. You could be reviewing copy. But people are so focused on their handbag and their glasses and their shoes and everything. And your media is part of that. And I think that's one of the really sad things, that we move to a digital world and there's no sense of definition. I'm wondering if that's maybe why also your print readership is so resilient still. Because I go over to your house and, oh, okay, you know, he or she is a Martha Stewart reader.
Right. I think that your devotees will stay your devotees, and it might filter down into their children and their children's children, of course. I think that we still don't know what the shakeout's going to be. We don't know. Is everybody going to be satisfied with the computer screen, with the tablet? I still am looking for the perfect device because I don't have it yet. iPad is getting heavy. Heavy.
Yeah.
And I'm not happy with it. I don't like the heaviness of it.
But you're a tactile person as well.
I am.
And I noticed you were using a BlackBerry earlier. I use a BlackBerry. It's like, don't you think it's amazing, going back to trying to use your tablet in the car, that we've arrived in a place in this wired society of ours, though, that you can have a signature at the end of using this device where it says, please excuse typos, spelling mistakes, etc.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to be in an era where accuracy is everything, but it's not. I mean,
it isn't at all. My daughter has that little thing at the end of her blog. Please, that forgive any typos. I don't have that because I really do reread if I can. But when I'm tweeting, for example, and I tweet about 5 minutes a day, and in the dark in the car, I'll make a typo. And spell check doesn't catch it because it's there or there or there, you know, three different ways to spell something. So it doesn't correct it. And I get tweets right back. Mm. You're drunk again. You're out of your mind. What's wrong with you? You should be no better than that. And how silly, because people are trying to, correct Martha.
Well, that's a problem right there. But aside from that, just the sense of reaction. And instant reaction, and I think sort of just the general rudeness that is also, has precipitated, I think, with this culture as well. That people think that, she made a mistake, he made a mistake, so therefore I can just sort of smack it right back. And you think, well, I'm also doing the courtesy of imparting a bit of information on you.
Right. So why be mean?
Yeah, why be mean?
Or nasty. And
do you think that might be part of the correction? I mean, just going back to, if we talk about this analog versus digital shakeout that might happen, that maybe part of the backlash, you know, might just come from the fact that there's so much anger that people have to feel like they backhand it, you know, right at you. And I somehow I feel like the tide might be turning a little bit.
Making it worse or better?
No, better. I think that some people...
hope so, because there's no reason. I mean, as you said, you're imparting something new and different to these people who are looking for the new and the different in the world of Twitter, for example, or Facebook, or any number, Pinterest or Instagram. They're looking for something different. Mm. They're looking, but what I can't understand is how they can spend so much time. I don't spend that kind of time. I just don't. I can't. I want to read. I want to write. I want to create. I want to learn. And that's not really the best way to do it.
No, I'm not on any of it.
Good.
No Facebook. No Twitter. I don't do any of it. I want to commission my writers. I want to see the world, do good things, and hopefully try to sleep on the plane.
But you write.
But I write. I write my column. And I always say to people, they say, why aren't you on Facebook? Why don't you do this? And I said, I write a column on the back page of the FT. I've got a magazine. We have a radio station now. Yeah. That's enough.
So you're imparting a lot of knowledge and a lot of text to people. Yeah. Now, where do you write your column?
Well, this goes back to the point about the keyboard and having something tactile. I can write my 900 words for my editor's letter for the magazine every week for the FT. I can bang that out on my BlackBerry.
So do
without
I.
mistake. Right.
I do that too. I write my columns on the BlackBerry in the car.
And that's something that you can do because there's that tactile reinforcement of having a keyboard.
Yep.
Do you think that there's a generational shift? And is that something that you discuss at a board level, with your editors, et cetera? Because, you know, as you said, here is the magazine's been around, since 90?
Yes, 1991. 1991.
Yeah. So if you look at what the state of running an editorial wall and just, you think 1991, there was barely internet. I mean, there was, but it wasn't really taking off.
Was minor compared to what happened.
Right.
It's happening today.
So, but yet you had a lot of people have been with you for a long time.
Yes.
So is there an editorial divide now in terms of the digital world, but even how people want to express themselves or what they think about the printed page?
No, because some of the people who have been with me longest are the ones who are spearheading the whole thrust into the digital world and creating the digital editions of the magazine. They have learned because they're learners. And as they use new ways to design the magazine graphically in 20 years ago, I mean, we weren't cutting and pasting. Not we were doing everything on the computer. Now we're doing so much more and finding the new ways to do an exciting cover or do video in our new magazines online. So it's fun for them. And how great it is that they have new and different and sometimes better ways to express themselves. But again, not everyone is buying it.
That was, of course, Martha Stewart speaking with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in a feature-length interview here on The Stack. Well, stay tuned, because after this short break, we'll be hearing Martha's views on the US election, entrepreneurs, and, of course, the print industry.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
From 8 a.m. London time and 9 a.m. Central European time every weekday, Monocle 24 presents The Continental Shift. Our editors guide you through 4 hours of hand-picked music, from Danish ballads to German electro-pop and beyond. That's The Continental Shift, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now we continue our special feature-length interview between Tyler Brulé and Martha Stewart.
We were talking about the digital versus print divide. I want to talk about just the business of media. You know, you grew up in an era when the 6:30 newscast was everything. There was a real state of news gathering internationally. You were able to find out what's going on in the world. Before we went on, we were just, you know, discussing some programs where it's very hard. They try to sell themselves as news shows in the US. They're not really doing news. They're kind of in the entertainment business. We're in an election year. Of course, there's plenty of news channels, but does it sometimes worry you? You know, we're sitting in London right now. US election is very important to us. But I feel here we still get a very good view, you know, on most outlets of what's going on in the entire world. Are you worried that sometimes that the news narrative is just a little bit too narrow when also we know all the challenge
and
that the US has?
Not only narrow, but also trite. My intake of news in the United States is 5:30, way too early with Willie Geist. He's good. A little too much time on sports, Willie, but he's good. And I get a good overview in a half an hour. Then starts Morning Joe. This is MSNBC. And I'm on the treadmill by then. And that's more, I would say, entertainment, political talk. I think they go on for 2 hours. I can't take them for more than a half an hour because it's just too much talk. And they're interrupting each other all the time. And there's odd dynamics going on. But they have very good people with good minds on that show who don't really get enough time to really express themselves. But they're good. And you want to know what they say because it helps you formulate, too, opinions about stuff. And it's pretty liberal, so that's good. Mm. And then, of course, there's the Today Show. There's CBS with Charlie Rose, who I adore. There's ABC with George Stephanopoulos, who's taken the Today Show, giving them a run for their money right now. So you have to choose, too. What do you want to learn? But at night, guess what I listen to? BBC. Because I get an overview for the world. It's like when you watch those morning programs, you don't even know there's another part of the world other than the U.S. and crime and stuff going on and maybe basic politics. But the BBC, you get to know what's really going on in Saudi Arabia and what's going on in Syria and what's going on in Egypt and England and Germany. I like it very much. I think they do a very good job.
And what about public broadcasting in America?
Oh, that's my morning show in the car.
Right.
That's what I listen to in the car on the radio. I listen to NPR radio, and they have very, very good commentary, very good news. And I am a news junkie. I read three newspapers while I'm listening to NPR radio. So, and I have to know what's going on.
So you mentioned BBC, this side of the Atlantic. What brought you to London?
Oh, we've been here, and this is my first time in quite a while. I've been having such a good time revisiting favorite old places and learning and seeing new places. I came over, basically, we have a very fine line of craft products, craft tools, craft punches, craft paper, craft extraordinary materials with which to craft. Crafting is becoming a very popular pastime, not only in the States, but elsewhere in the world.
Is that for all the obvious reasons, going back to what we were discussing at the beginning, because we're in this digi-backlit world that, of course, there is a reaction to that?
Well, there is a reaction to that, but it's also a form of entertainment at home and a self-fulfillment at home that isn't so break the bank. I mean, you can go to a Broadway play every night and then not have anything to buy your food with, but you can stay at home and make memories. And it's not just scrapbooking. It's also, we use the digital world. We use templates that are very exciting. We use tools that are the best of the breed in the craft world. So we sell these crafts in the States in Michael's stores and Joanne Fabrics and Independence, here in the UK in independent craft stores. And it's a booming business. Craft world is $30 billion in revenue in the United States. And people buy a lot of it via television. They like to see the demo and then buy the product. So we're doing QVC here. Hmm. I haven't done QVC here in England. I don't know what it's like. All I know is we've been very successful with our products, with some of my colleagues presenting. So I'm going to present on Sunday.
Is there also an interest at a time when, of course, the economy has been wobbly in no shortage of markets? Going back to that notion of craft, and we've seen, of course, craft jump beyond the kitchen table and craft really becoming a cottage industry for many, and that sense of entrepreneurialism as well. Does that play into it too?
Oh, to me, one of the nicest things that's happening is the, as you say, the entrepreneurial initiative at home. Many crafts have turned into artisanal works of art. I mean, they're great. They then turn into artwork. They then turn into product. We are celebrating 10 fine entrepreneurs in a big celebration on October 16th, 17th, and 18th in New York City called American Made. And we have a program going on. We've zeroed in on these 10 artisans. I call them artisans, but they really are entrepreneurs. Oh, there we have two guys who started a cheese cave in Vermont. They found a beautiful spot where it was the perfect temperature for aging cheeses. So they have made available room in the cave for other artisanal cheesemakers who can't afford or can't make a cave. It's where they can age their goudas or their cheddars. And it's offering not only a public service, but a very viable shipping and handling part for these cheesemakers.
It sounds to me like there's a spin-off magazine on the horizon.
Or how about a TV show?
Or a TV show. But don't you think when you look on the U.S. newsstand, there's Inc. magazine and there are magazines there for small business. But how many times can you reinvent the story about sort of, the 10 easy ways to set up shop? But none of them are very inspirational. I think that's what's amazing. Oftentimes, we were talking about the Japanese newsstand earlier, that you just see these people who are setting up their jam businesses, and then they set up their little stand on, and then it goes through every step
the
of the branding
flea.
And everything.
They started the Brooklyn Flea. They then go into Bergdorf's. And two young people who worked for me for several years in my art department, the creative department of the magazine, they have started a business called Belloc Teas, B-E-L-L-O-C-Q. Beautifully packaged. They are in Bergdorf Goodman, Saks Fifth Avenue. They're all over the country in these beautiful yellow, antique-looking tea caddies, tin, lined with silver. Fabulous. And they are doing so well. They travel all over China finding vintage teas and finding unusual artisanal grown teas in India and Darjeeling, all over the place. And I am so proud of them. They are fantastic. And what they're doing is art. It's really art, artisanal craft, everything.
Hmm. We talked about the election year a little earlier. If we come down to really, it's razor's edge with this election. Does America look more polarized to you in 2013? I mean, it's quite polarized already, as we were just saying. What does it look like?
It depends on who wins, really and truly. And I don't know. I just don't know. It is a very, very difficult time for Americans. We have to make up our minds what we really want, and we have to go for it. It's hard.
Mm. Finally, before we go, you started with books, and we were touching on just the whole notion of e-readers, etc. I mean, how important is that to the business still, though?
The books?
The books.
Oh, very important. We've published 77 best-selling books. Our next book is coming out in January called Meatless, and it's our first vegetarian cookbook. And the trend in America is pretty strong.
And is that a gut reaction to do that, Martha? That, okay, let's do a meatless book, or it's because the publishing company says there is just this surge of people demanding it?
No, it's not about what they say, the publisher. And we've had the same publisher forever. It's Clarkson Potter, part of Random House, part of Bertelsmann. No, it's not that. We wanted to do a meatless cookbook because we have published many wonderful meatless recipes. The next book that's coming out, I'm very proud of. It's called Living the Good Long Life. And it is, and I promised that to the Clinton Global Initiative 3 years ago, that I would publish a book that will help people grow older, better, healthier. So I've done it. And I can't wait till it comes out because it's a really, really good book guiding people in not only caring for themselves, but caring for others and giving them advice on exercise and and medical use and all kinds of stuff. It's a good book.
Martha Stewart, thanks very much for joining us on the
Stack. Thank you.
That was indeed Martha Stewart speaking with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. And that brings us to the end of Edition 7 of The Stack. My guests today were Marion Hume, Ben Easton, and of course Martha Stewart, who we were just hearing from. Our producers were Dawn Trump and Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time with a very special programme from Toronto. The review will be coming up at midday, here from Midori House with Andrew Muller and Tom Burgess Watson. You can listen to all of the wonderful treats you've had this morning again via monocle.com or on iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye and have a great weekend.